Hi, I'm Rosie Wickett, and this is a Storytime podcast. This is a recording of an event that took place on the 29th of November at Cheetham School of Music in Manchester. It's a series of short talks on the theme of ghosts. The first talk is by Dr. Sasha Handley, who is a lecturer in early modern history at the University of Manchester. Her talk was called The Apparition of Mrs. Veal and Other Stories, Ghosts in the Early Modern Era. Please do listen to Alison Criddle's fantastic talk, The Phantom Madeline, Haunted by the Image of a Woman Who Never Was, which is based on Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. Alison is a PhD candidate in the Department of Art History and Visual Studies at the University of Manchester, and we've separated the talk off so that you can look at the images whilst you listen to the talk.
I took seriously your instruction not to be an academic for the evening, so I will attempt to do that. And mostly I'm just going to be telling you about the best-selling ghost story of the 18th century. So I'll just sort of outline the basics of the story itself, and then draw out some of the meanings that I've taken from it in my own work, featuring people and life stories, which hopefully kind of fits in with the theme of some of the workshops that have been put together as part of this series. So the story that I'm interested in is called The True Relation of the Apparition of One Mrs. Veal. It was published in 1706, possibly by Daniel Defoe, and it does become the best-selling ghost story of the 18th century and is republished through numerous editions well into the 19th century. I think it's a really useful foundation for thinking about some of the central meanings that early modern ghost stories have and the way they interacted with ordinary people's emotional lives and expectations. So let's have a little look at the story itself. The two main characters that feature are Mrs. Margaret Bargrave, who lives in Canterbury, and her friend Mary Veal, who lives in Dover. They're long-standing friends, and the action begins on Saturday, the 8th of September, 1705. And here we have a description drawn from possibly Defoe's account. Some question marks over the authorship of this, doesn't really matter. But Margaret's sitting at home, just whiling away a boring Saturday in her house, and she hears a rustle at the door. So the top description there is the beginning of the tale. So on Saturday, September the 8th, Mrs. Bargrave, being in her little house alone, she heard a little kind of rustle, noted it had just struck 12 at noon. Looking towards the door, in came Mrs. Veal with a wrapping gown and a handsome suit of night clothes and hood. So, you know, I've already kind of revealed that potentially there's a ghost lurking here. Some of the physical descriptions are kind of cues as to what might be going on. So she appears at the door. The two women greet each other. They haven't seen each other for a while. They sit down in comfy armchairs, and Margaret Bargrave starts to tell her tales of woe, which are mainly about her husband, who's a big reprobate. He consorts with prostitutes. She once caught him. One of his ladies was running away, and she sort of saw her jumping over a wall to try and hide. He's a drunk. The reason they've ended up in Canterbury is because he's lost his job in Dover on account of his drunkenness and carelessness. He also apparently is subjecting her to forms of domestic abuse. He locks her out of the house on regular occasions. And in fact, later this day, he comes home drunk and locks her in the wash house for the night, and she catches a fever and gets very ill. So he's not a nice man, and she sits and tells Mary all about this. And Mary, like a good friend, responds and says, "Well, never mind, you're a good Christian and you'll be rewarded in the next life for all of this abuse and suffering." So she offers words of spiritual consolation, and she says, "There's a really good book that you should read, which is by a man called Charles Drelincourt, a Protestant minister." Oh, there's somebody else at the door. Called Consolations Against the Fear of Death. So her comfort is to be found in heaven, where surely she'll go for putting up with all of this nastiness from her husband. And interestingly enough, as this story takes off, and gets republished time and time again. Charles Drelincourt's book, The Sales Skyrocket, Absolutely Skyrocket, which also make it the subject of a lot of controversy and suspicions of fraud. Anyway, after the two have had their discussions, Mary gets up to leave and notes that it was exactly 1:45 in the afternoon when she wandered off. She arrived at 12, left at 1:45, and Saturday goes on without any further exciting events. The Monday following, however, Margaret goes to seek out her friend again, and she goes to a local neighbour's house where she thinks that she might be staying. And this is where we have the second extract here. So on Monday morning, Mrs. Bargrave goes to Mr. Watson's to inquire after Mary Veal. They were surprised, however, at her inquiring and said they were sure by their not seeing her that she could not have been in Canterbury. In the meantime, Captain Watson came in and told them of preparations making in town for the funeral of some person of note in Dover. This quickly raised apprehensions in Mrs. Bargrave, who flew away directly to the undertaker's and was no sooner informed it was for Mrs. Veal. And she faints. And she discovers that the time of death was 12 noon on Friday the 7th of September. So exactly one day, but at the exact time that she knocked on the door of the house and went to visit her friend in Canterbury. Therefore, it is a ghost. This is the ghost of Mary Veal. So this becomes something of a cause célèbre, and there are lots of different ways in which this tale could be investigated and was investigated. Interestingly, early members of the Royal Society were very keen on getting the details of lots of kinds of supernatural stories. John Flamsteed, the first astronomer royal, sent a friend of his who lived in Canterbury to go and interview Margaret and other witnesses, her friends and neighbours, maidservants who might have seen Mary going in or out of the house. And this is an image of Daniel Defoe, who we think probably wrote the most famous account of the tale. But there's lots of private correspondence available on this story. It's really richly documented. So, you know, you could look at this in the context of the rise of Enlightenment thought or natural philosophy. But today I really just wanted to think about what the relationship is between these kinds of tales and ordinary people's lives. And to that end, this is my theory, actually, that ghost stories in the early modern period are a form of protest narrative, particularly for marginalised groups who don't really have access to other means of protest, i.e. they can't afford to bring expensive lawsuits against certain people. It's particularly important in the case of women because according to the law at this time, married women had no legal status independently of their husbands. Therefore, if your husband is the cause of your disgruntlement, you have no legal recourse to do anything about that. The reason why ghost stories are a useful way of spreading tales of abuse is that, you know, they circulate in these sort of oral contexts, and they were very much, the expectations of them were very much as upholders of social justice, principles of social justice. Here are just a few examples from a similar time period that illustrate some of the themes that these stories engage with. So it's not just about forms of domestic abuse, although that's fairly common. They also are thought to reveal secret murderers or criminals that have gone unpunished. Inconstant lovers who jilted kind of pregnant women but not married them, and any other kind of instances of irreligion and immorality. So they're very much tied to the teachings of the church. They're really firmly grounded in people's religious beliefs, and so they appear with divine sanction as if on a mission from God to punish those who have escaped justice. So this is why I have been interested in them. And I suppose the only other point I wanted to make in terms of why they're effective. It's not just because people actually believe that these things were real and were supported by the church. It's also the fact that reputation in the early modern period was absolutely crucial to the way in which you lived your sort of ordinary life. So if I went around saying, Richard Bargrave, you consort with prostitutes, you're a drunk, you beat your wife, you might be refused credit at the local butcher's shop, you might be cast out of the church. There are any number of sort of informal punishments that would be inflicted upon you by the local community. So that's why I like them, because they are a way of seeing into the lives of people who don't really appear on the historical record in any other places. And they are these printed stories. I think you can still hear the voices in them, and they're very much growing out of this sort of storytelling culture, and the performance aspect of ghost stories, the art of persuasion, I think is something that anybody could learn to be good at, irrespective of whether you could read or write. So the fact that some of these people were not necessarily highly literate, highly educated, it doesn't really matter that much. So I think that's probably as much as I have to say about why Mrs. Veal might be interesting. So perhaps I'll leave it there and see if this kind of interacts with the rest of our speakers.
The second talk is by Stephen McNeely, who is the editor and curator at the Swedenborg Society, and his talk was called Swedenborg Summer House: Voices from the Past.
This what I would hope to talk about essentially is ongoing research that I've been doing for 20 years, I suppose, on and off, and it's relative to a house in Sweden in an open air museum in Skansen. This house is about 250 years old. It's an 18th century house, and it's about the inhabitant or the author of that house, who was he was many things. He was a statesman, he was a philosopher, a scientist, but later in life he was a mystic as well. And this was his house, and it's a story about him and his house. And my research is basically geared towards a book that I'm producing, which is a montage of various things, photography, essays, historical documents related to this house and what went on in it. Now, this house is famous for two reasons. Swedenborg actually was a famous figure of history until a certain moment. And while he was alive, he was a very famous Swede. He was probably one of the most respected gentlemen of his day, and he was a nobleman, a politician. Now, this house is interesting because he had it built personally at the end of his garden in about 1750, and he died in 1772. So it's a 22-year period whereby he was sitting in this place, working away. In the summertime, he would visit there almost every day, sometimes as 15 to 16 hours. He had a little bed at the back. By the time of his death, this little house was recognised as being synonymous with Swedenborg. There was even in then, there were tourists just to come and visit, and he had to see his garden, had to act as a kind of bouncer to vet people as they were coming in and out. So because of that, it's in Sweden, it's actually quite a famous little house, and you find itself on Swedish stamps and even on the currency and various things like that. It's a very curious thing. At the same time as all that, there was something else going on, which is kind of secret history of the house. And this is the reason why I'm bringing it up here today, as we'll get around to it eventually, is that for that 20-year period, Swedenborg claimed he could speak with the dead. Now, for quite a long period of time, he kept that to himself. He published a whole series of books, one titled Heaven and Hell, one was the biblical exegesis of the Bible, a whole series of quite fabulous books, really, that he published anonymously, while also continuing to be a politician, continuing to serve in the House of the Swedish Diet, presenting papers on monetary, economic, etc. So this house, in a way, it's still there. It's been moved twice, oddly enough, but it was after his death, the property around it was all developed, and then they kept this house, and the main building was knocked down, but somehow this house has been retained, and it's been moved twice, once to Skansen and then to another place, and it's had this garden built around it. So it's got this kind of, I suppose, double identity, and it's... The second aspect, it's often described as being a kind of Swedenborg's portal to the other world. I mean, there are very specific reasons why he engaged in this space. And for me, I would have to say that it's a portal to him. It's in my ongoing research is to do with this rather extraordinary gentleman. somehow I constantly gravitate around this summer house as a focal point to try and understand him. Now, at this stage, I probably ought to say what my research could possibly be around someone like this. All I can say is that for 20 years, you know, I first discovered him when I was a student with Easter at Nottingham, and they both thought I was a bit odd at the time, I suspect. and I've had an ongoing, quite difficult relationship with him since. And my subsequent practice is to do with art, essentially, but I underwent a PhD in philosophy and various other activities as well. All of this time, even occasional filmmaking with this gentleman here and other activities and photography. All of this time, somehow this chap has continued to present himself to me as a kind of as a problem and as a point of interest. And so I now actually work as the curator and the main editor of a place called the Swedenborg Society in London for my sins. And that means that I'm actually responsible for producing the books, the exhibitions, etc., etc. And so, hence the background for this reason. Now, the obvious question that's normally raised is Swedenborg's mental health, and mine sometimes as well, with being interested in it. But and claims that the studies, actually formal documented studies have been made as to whether he was a schizophrenic, etc. And that's all very, very interesting, but essentially it's never been something that's interested me personally. I've never, oddly enough, been that concerned or interested about whether he was mad or not. Just in the same way I was never particularly interested about whether William Blake was mad or not. There is something about this man and the nature of his work that is so compellingly diverse, strange, challenging, mad, in I hope a good way, but also... There's been a whole series of subsequent generations who have found something uniquely compelling about him. William Blake is the obvious one. He's often called the disciple of Swedenborg, but his books are deeply, deeply embedded in Swedenborgian thought, as are people like Jorge Luis Borges more recently. And they saw in this kind of world that Swedenborg encourages us to believe is true a kind of imaginal space. So people have been able to enter it quite easily, I suspect. And from him, they've been able to pull all sorts of interesting ideas, etc., about their own relationship to their own writing, etc. Right, now that was way off topic to what I was expecting to say, and I'm trying to work out what I'm going to say now. In this space, what he did, so while he was writing his books and his memorandum for the political elite, etc., he was writing a diary of all of these spiritual experiences, or these ghosts, these spirit-type people he was talking to. Now, I was responsible for bringing a new edition of this out, and this isn't it. This is just the first volume of a whole series of volumes. For 22 years, every day, this man was writing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages and manuscripts, handwritten. He had no helper, he had no menus, nothing there at all, just him and his pen. Sometimes 20 hours a day, writing, writing, writing. And a constant feature of these descriptions is how utterly mundane they are. This is something that Borges criticizes, but says there's something refreshingly authentic about the absolutely mundanity of it. And he's almost like a minute taker. I don't know if you ever, again, had the displeasure of having to sit around a board table and someone's sitting there taking the minutes. He is the minute taker. He's entering all dialogues that are constantly coming forward, and he's writing them down day by day by day. And another interesting thing about this diary is that it's not numbered by date, it's numbered by paragraphs. Again, like a typical minute taker. And not only did he write those things, he actually compiled an index, several indexes explaining exactly who he was speaking to at a given time, who he met, etc., etc. So there's whole multiple layers of text that developed out of these experiences. That somehow, in a way, is absolutely, for me, synonymous with this space. Most of it happened in this space, not entirely, but most of it happened in this space. And for me personally, I thought that's an extraordinary, regardless of whether it's true or not, And if it is schizophrenia, then it's an impressive form of schizophrenia in a way. It's actually, really extraordinary. Okay, that's off message again. Now, where am I going to? Yeah, so being a scientist and being a philosopher and someone who studied anatomy and all various things, part of his approach to this experience, as I suspect ours wouldn't be, to go to the doctor and get some antidepressants. He embraced it head on. I mean, he literally engaged with it, he analysed it, He constructed theories about it. He constructed an entire philosophy around the nature of these experiences. He constructed worlds, whole imaginable worlds around the nature of the experiences. He claimed to have visited spirits on other planets, or he claimed that they came to visit him in this little room. And he also claims to have had conversations with people like Aristotle, Luther, St. Paul even. And these conversations are all minutely kind of described and written down. And some of them are quite touching, you know, but often it's quite boring, you know. Sometimes St. Paul came to me today and complained that I was talking too much about, you know, charity above faith, and we had a discourse, and he said that Peter was wrong, and then he went away again, you know. It was it's quite extraordinary. I'm not going to rub it on too much. One of the interesting things that comes from the nature of experience is that, or the nature of place itself, which chimes quite neatly with my ideas of place and my own, I suppose, artistic ideas. One of the things that he knows, that's Swedenborg's organ. Oops, that was... there we go, there's another one there. One of the odd observations about this place, I'm not going to go on forever, is that he says that whereas... I'm trying not to be too jargon about this now. Whereas we all experience a common objectivity, I'm not going to get too philosophical now, but these are my interests, so I'll try and be as short as possible. We all share a common sense that, you know, that's a speaker, that's whatever it is. We're in a room, red chairs, and we can all agree, and one of the natures of objectivity is that there's a shared experience. And what distinguishes that between our subjectivity is that when we have our feelings, we feel that they are very much our own, and that we don't actually see those feelings being shared by other people, and they cannot access those feelings. So the dichotomy, if you like, between an inner and outer world is based upon a sense of community, of sharing. Well, if you can imagine Swedenborg in a nutshell, Swedenborg's, when he entered this spiritual world, or whatever it was, these ghosts, or whatever it was he saw, he never conceived them as apparitions in a formal sense of a ghost story. He saw himself as suddenly entering into a subjective community that was like our objective community. His claim was is that underneath this all, we are actually connected in the same way that we are objective. And because of that, it has laws, it has rules, it has governance principles, but they're just different to what they are here. So space and time are governed by design. We, in this world, that which we are surrounded by are those things that we love. And those things that we don't love are always far away removed. Time is based upon the sense of use. So time goes really slowly if you're not fulfilling a perfect use. Time goes really, really quickly in this world when you're engaged in a useful purpose. So he develops this whole philosophical structure, how the nature of these things are. Now, those descriptions have hugely influenced modern philosophy, modern literature. I mean, like people like Henri Bergson have taken those out of Swedenborg and applied that to his modern notion, Dürer. It is compelling how these ideas have absorbed into our, you know, contemporary philosophical artistic life, etc. But one of the ones that I like, which is not to do with that at all, is that for Swedenborg, we construct our space, our inner world, rather than this world, where our sense of self is determined by what's outside us. In this other world, we actually, the environment that we are in is a perfect reflection of actually who we are. So for me, that's why this house is so perfectly mirrored in Swedenborg. He constructed it himself. He spent 22 years here, writing, thinking, being himself. It was his perfect correspondence. In a way, it is here. It's his kind of, I see it as his material body, and that's the basis of the book that I hope to produce. But the other thing was is that he also claims that because all of us share this common subjectivity, these things are always happening around us all of the time. And he often complained that these spirits have a really sensitive sense of place as well, and that when they used to come and visit him, if he wasn't in there, they used to complain. And there's one particular passage which is even more curious, where he's outside in the garden. He walks outside in the garden, and all of a sudden the spirits that are talking to him suddenly can't speak. They lose the ability to be able to articulate. And then he walks back in the house, and all of a sudden they become articulate again.
And lastly, Stephen Gordon, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of English at the University of Manchester. whose talk was entitled "I Know Not Why the Corpses of the Dead Should Wander: Zombies in the Medieval Period, Some Consideration."
Okay, yeah, so for my talk, I'm going to be discussing a bit about zombies or revenants in medieval England. The reason I got onto this topic was because quite a few scholars in quite a few of the books I've been looking at before starting my PhD, they kind of take the view that tales of the Walking Dead originated in the early modern period, and even they originated from Eastern Europe. Well, in my research over the last few years, I've kind of found that this isn't really the case. Well, this is a topic for a different paper, and I won't bore you with it, but it was through basically a quirk of historical contingency that tales of a Slavic vampire began to circulate in the courts of Western Europe and thereafter became an entrenched part of popular culture. But having investigated the British manuscript sources, there's actually quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the Walking Dead were an everyday, kind of almost mundane threat in the medieval England as well. So for today, I've just got a few stories that I want to share with you all. Okay, some of the stories, especially from Anglo-Saxon and early Anglo-Norman periods, are quite short and oblique. For example, the following tale from William and Malmesbury's Gesta Pontificum Anglorum, which basically translates as the Deeds of the Bishops of England. This was written in 1122, but it details events that occurred in 1090, so just after the conquest. Okay, so to quote, "Ancient tradition has it that Bishop Brightward, being slow to do good but quick to do evil, came to a pitiful end, dying in the town surrounded by the materials for a drinking bout, and was buried among his predecessors in the Church of St. Andrew in the Abbey of Malmesbury. It is generally believed that the watchmen at the church were disturbed by dreamlike shadowy shapes until they dug up Brightward's body and sunk it into a deep marsh far away from the monastery. At intervals, a noxious smell rose from the marsh and spread its, quote, noise and stench over the countryside." So, as you can see, this story makes only kind of a tangential reference to the actual body of the bishop. The reader, needs to fill in the gaps. But another one of William's anecdotes contains a much more overt reference to the Walking Dead. This one concerns the corpse of King Alfred. To quote, "They say that Alfred was buried first in the cathedral because his own monastery, Winchester, was still unfinished, but that not long after, the deluded canons maintained that the king's ghost returned to his dead body and wandered at night through their lodgings, and so his son and successor took up his father's remains and laid them in peace in the new monastery. This nonsense and the like, it is believed, for example, that the corpse of a criminal after death is possessed by demons and warts, wins credit among the English from a sort of inborn credulity. They borrow it, no doubt, from the pagans, as in Virgil's line, quote, such shapes are said to wander after death." Okay, so this is a bit more overt than the last example, but it's still kind of, I mean, this takes up, it's basically one passage in a book which is two volumes, which is massive, basically. But as we go towards the end of the 12th century, due to various kind of cultural, social reasons, stories about the Walking Dead become much more explicit. For example, the next story is from William of Newburgh's History of English Affairs, which was written in 1198. According to William, a series of strange and terrifying events befell the inhabitants of the town of Alnwick in Northumberland in the spring of 1196. A nameless outlaw, having fled from the authorities in York, insinuated himself within the household of the lord of the castle. The man married a local woman, but it was not long before he began to suspect his wife of having an affair. Under the pretense of, quote, going on a journey from which he would not return for some days, he hid in the beams of the marriage chamber, where, sure enough, his suspicions were confirmed. Enraged, the man fell from the crossbeam where he was hiding, and suffering grave injuries and dying before he could receive confession from a priest. But death did not quell the man's anger for long. Emerging from the grave each night, his corpse, quote, issuing by the handiwork of Satan, wandered the streets of Alnwick, pursued by a pack of howling dogs and a terrible pestilent stench. Many people died from the disease brought forth by the, quote, pestiferous breath of the carcass. Finally, Two brothers, whose father had already succumbed to the plague, decided to exhume the errant corpse and, quote, burn it with fire. They found it swollen, its face suffused with blood, and the burial shroud torn to pieces. Remembering that the only way to assuage walking corpses was to destroy the heart, which, as of the quote here, was said to be filled with the blood of many persons, one of the brothers thrust his hand into the corpse's side, removed the organ and tore it piecemeal. The corpse was then placed on a pyre and burnt to ashes. And once these actions had been taken, the corrupted air seemed to purify, thus ending the epidemic. So this is one of four stories from William's history, and I think this is the most evocative, actually. I think it's interesting for a number of different reasons. Firstly, William describes the corpse as a, my Latin's a bit dodgy, a sanguisuga. One of the translations for this is leech, but it has the general connotations of bloodsucker. Since this is probably, I think, is a learned Latin transliteration of a unrecorded Old English term or concept, and the fact that the brothers noted that the corpse was filled with the blood of many people, I'm pretty convinced, not sure how right I am, that this is the first extant use of a synonym for vampire in the written record in England, although this may be proven incorrect, I'm not sure. So the second story from this period, so the late 1180s, early 1190s, is from the satirist Walter Mapp. Walter was a clerk in Henry II's court, and he enjoyed contemporary fame as a raconteur and a wit. As a well-known satirist in his day, his revenant stories, his zombie stories, play with and subvert the accepted academic conventions. So to quote Mapp, "I know too that in the time of Roger, Bishop of Worcester, a man, reported to have died unchristianly, for a month or more wandered about in his shroud, both at night and also in the open day, till the whole population of the neighbourhood laid siege to him in an orchard, and there he remained exposed to view, it is said, for 3 days. I know further that this Roger ordered a cross to be laid upon the grave of the wretch, and the man himself to be let go. When, followed by the people, he came to the grave, he started back, apparently at the sight of the cross, and ran in another direction. Whereupon they wisely removed the cross. He sank into the grave, the earth closed up over him, the cross was laid on it, and he remained quiet thereafter." So I think there's kind of a wry humour running through this particular story. Firstly, there's a reversal in the type of agency displayed by the revenant. So it's the crowd who are laying siege to the corpse and not vice versa, which is like a common trope in these types of narratives. Secondly, the bishop places the protective device in the grave without the corpse in it. So repelled by the cross, it ends up running in a random in another direction. Again, this is a kind of a subversion of a common trope for this kind of narrative. Advice from the clergy ends up causing more trouble for everyone, rather than putting the corpse to rest as commonly expected. Okay, and the third major revenant story from this particular period can be found in Geoffrey of Burton's Life and Miracles of St. Modwenna. This was written between about 1110 and 1150, and it's like a basic hagiography, you know, explaining the miracles and life of the saint and basically advertising the particular place where the saint's bones are kept. But in one of his little... it's split into two parts. First half is the life and deeds in life, and then the miracles after death. So in the second half of the book, Geoffrey describes how in 1090, two peasants fled from the lands of Stapenhall Abbey in Burton, where Modwenna's bones are kept, to enter the service of the knight Roger de Pointevin in the nearby village of Draycloy. With the peasants' betrayal having incited conflict between the abbey and Roger, the monks petitioned St. Modwenna for help. Divine justice was swift and immediate. The peasants were, quote, struck down dead and buried in Stapenhill Cemetery. However, that very evening, and for many nights thereafter, the corpses rose out of their graves and trod the same path to Draycloe as they had taken in life, carrying their coffins on their backs. Death and disease accompanied their reappearance, engulfing Draycloe until only 3 villages remained. To contain the epidemic, the remaining peasants' corpses, the original ones who basically swapped over to the secular lord. The corpses were exhumed, decapitated, and their heads placed between their legs. Following this, their hearts were removed and burnt on a pyre, whereupon, quote, an evil spirit in the form of a crow emerged from the flames. Only then did the revenant sighting cease. Okay, so you probably expect, as the church got a bit more kind of critical about these popular practices, because this is very uncanonical kind of beliefs, these about walking dead and zombies and whatnot, you kind of expect that stories about this would cease, especially in like the histories and the kind of the lives of saints and stuff like that. But this is only partially true, I think. Sometimes, very rarely, traces of these kind of folk beliefs can be seen in the later written record. Okay, the following and final story is taken from a parchment roll known as the Arnbone Papers. And I chose this because this is actually stored in the library in Cheetham's. And it dates from between 1417 and 1450. The running theme in these papers is an inheritance feud between the Arnbergs, who were a kind of a gentrified Warwickshire family, and various other local families. In one part of the roll, Joan Arnberg, the author, breaks off from talking business to describe how, quote, a certain John Sumpter went hunting with a noble lady, but fell from his horse and died without receiving confession. And afterwards, he walked and has done much harm, as is openly known in the country thereabout. I just put the Middle English version on there. So I think it should be stressed that the Arnbergs weren't just some kind of superstitious peasants. They were a relatively high-status family. This extract shows that even in the 15th century, and in a relatively high-status environment, some of the habits and beliefs regarding restless corpses lived on. Okay, so this is just an overview of some of the narratives I'm looking at for my PhD. Hopefully, I'll be able to just illustrate a bit that the fear of the restless corpse and the fear of the walking dead was an entrenched, if somewhat overlooked, part of the medieval belief system. Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.